like a company. Ready!
The Chronicles of the American Civil War begins now. And here's your host, Bob O'Connor.
The years creep slowly by, Lorena. The snow is on the grass again.
Welcome to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is podcast number 74. I'm your host, Bob O'Connor. We are broadcasting from the podcast studio of Radio Heart Media, now known as Sounder and Key. Logistically, this podcast will post each week on Thursday afternoon as is available on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play. Today, we will spend a few seconds on my book, The United States Colored Troops at Andersonville Prison, in honor of Black History Month. The book is my first of over a dozen books from my research on the black soldiers of the Union Army. In total, there were over 206,000 black Union soldiers. Abraham Lincoln said the war would have lasted longer and may not have been won had the black soldiers not fought on the side of the Union. My Andersonville book is the record of 105 black prisoners held at that prison. By the way, the first and second podcasts on this program, going way back to September 2017, was about that infamous prison. For information on any of my books, please check out my website at www.BobOConnorBooks.com. You're listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is your host, Bob O'Connor. We'll be right back. Our guest today is the second program with Bob Zeller, the founder of the Center for Civil War Photography. We had a really interesting discussion last week, and we're going to continue that because there's still lots of questions that we need to ask him. Welcome back, Bob.
Thank you.
Will you remind my listeners a little bit about your background and your founding of the Center for Civil War Photography?
Well, I'm a writer. I used to be a newspaper reporter for about 25 years, and that led to my first book, which was, as I mentioned on the last week's episode, if you wanted to collect original Antietam photographs, the format in which you find them most frequently is a stereo view, because most of the photographs of Antietam and most of the documentary photographs of the Civil War were shot in 3D. And so at some point in time, I said, somebody's got to do a 3D photo history of the war, because you know nobody knows about this.
Right.
And so that was my first book, The Civil War in Depth. And I started giving slideshows that same year it was published, 1997. And, you know, I think for about 15 years afterwards, every show I gave, somebody would come up to me afterwards, Civil War buffs, hardcore, you know, and say, I had no idea the photographs were taken like that.
Right.
And really, the shows we have, we pass out the glasses, are spectacular. I mean, they're just... they just bring a whole new dimension. If a Civil War buff isn't familiar with the 3D aspect of the war's photographs, which are probably the single most graphic element that draws us to that war, that allows us to relate to the Civil War, are the photographs,
right?
Because we can see what happened, and to know that to be on the cutting edge of presenting the 3D format and all these incredible photographs in 3D has been, you know, just really the greatest thing of my career.
Well, the folks that are my age, and I'm 73, that grew up in the 50s and 60s, we thought 3D movies were, that was a new invention.
Really. Yeah, and the Civil War books we were looking at had all these cool photos.
Right.
But nobody ever said anything, well, this one... I'll sit there and watch Ken Burns' series today, and I'll go, well, that photo's 3D, that
right,
one's 3D,
right.
That one's 3D.
But he never said anything about it.
Never mentioned it.
Right.
There's little mentions here and there. Bill Frassinito's cutting-edge studies of the photographs at Antietam and Gettysburg and Virginia refer to stereo views, and there's one reproduced in an Antietam book. But there hadn't been a lot done before that first book in 97 that I did. And it's fun to watch and see everybody who's picked up on that and all the different books that have been published since then. that incorporate the 3D aspect.
Obviously, there were photographs prior to the Civil War, yet the newspapers of the day carried elaborate drawings. Why did those newspapers not publish the photographs?
Well, because the half-tone process, which was the way using thousands of little dots, different colored dots, to convert a photograph into something that can be published on a printed page, did not come along until about the 1880s. Most frequently during the war, it was portraits of generals and commanders. Sometimes the battlefield photographs, like Antietam. One thing we know about the impact of Antietam is that the Harper's Weekly of mid-October, October 18, 1862, the center spread was nothing but woodcut engravings of the photographs, some of which showed the dead at Antietam.
What are some of your all-time favorite Civil War photographs?
One thing that always intrigued me from childhood was, were there any action photographs taken during the war? Did anybody catch, you know, battle action? Right. And one of the earliest books I had a photograph of a reported to show a shell exploding inside Fort Sumter. Right in the first volume, at page 20 or 30, is this magnificent photo of in Charleston Harbor, taken from Fort Sumter, showing the Ironsides and two monitors, and it said it was taken during the battle, and you can see smoke coming off the Ironsides. But the way that Miller's photographic history looked, the reproduction, it was like, I'm not sure if that smoke wasn't added, you know. And in the course of researching my history of Civil War photography, the blue and gray and black and white, I'm Allentown Museum, looking at the collection of George S. Cook, who was the best-known photographer in Charleston, and probably the greatest research day ever, the Valentine. I sort of began to uncover the secrets of George Cook's entire Civil War business day by day, and literally used them in my book to recreate the business of a southern business during the war, and how inflation absolutely crushed that business. But toward the end of this day, I was killing a little bit of time, so I was looking through a card catalog, an old catalog of Cook's negative collections, and my eyes fell on Iron Action, and I asked the curator if she could pull this. And she pulled the thing, and it was the original negatives. And it turned out that it was a stereo view. And the original negative of the Ironsides in Action, and long before I found the original negative, when I was doing my first book, I had decided to include a chapter called A Sense of Action, and to show the stereo views I'd found that most closely looked like action images. And I was going to put this Ironsides in Action in because at that time I only had a single photograph of it. But I compared the photograph in Miller's photographic history of the Ironsides in Action with the version that was in the Image of War and discovered that they were not exactly the same photograph, and rushed down to the local hardware store, made photocopies of both, made sure they were sized properly, put a stereo viewer to them, and the whole scene blew out in 3D in my eyes. It still sends chills up my spine to describe it today, because here I am producing the first 3D photo history of the war, and this is like about my favorite photograph, close to it, and to discover that it was actually a stereo view, and I was able to then reproduce it in the book in stereo for 3D viewing. And the first part of the story came several years later when I actually discovered that the original negatives to those two images still existed. It's a photograph that's just ended up in about three of my books because of the new discoveries we've made over the years. So that's certainly one of the biggest. And perhaps the other is in collecting Antietam photographs, I had a single print that was mounted on an imprinted mount with both Brady and Gardner's names. And Alexander Gardner was Matthew Brady's Washington gallery manager, but he split to start his own gallery at the beginning of 1863. So any Antietam photographs on a mount with both of their names means that it was made within weeks of the battle. And I had one. It was destroyed in the mail as I was trying to send it off to get conserved. And a dealer at the same time, this was 1993, happened to have another print that I already owned, but it was on one of those mounts with both Brady and Gardner's names. So I made arrangements to pick it up from him in Gettysburg, in front of the Gettysburg Hotel on January 2nd, 1993. And I told him about the disaster I'd had with the other picture, and he said, yeah, I might have that one at home. I have more of these. And he went home, and he brought back this portfolio with gold letters stamped, incidents of the war, which I knew was Gardner's catchphrase. And the portfolio, this huge book cover, just amazing. He starts opening it up, and there's one Antietam photograph after another, and the third one is one I've never seen before, of Burnside Bridge, but with a wagon on the bridge. And it ended up being, I acquired most of the photographs and the book cover. Three of them ended up being unknown, unpublished views by Alexander Gardner on these Gardner-Brady mounts. And one of the views was a private photograph, I figured out in kind of research and study, of McClellan, George McClellan's staff having a cocktail party on the Antietam battlefield at the time of Lincoln's visit in October, early October 1862. There is a separate photograph that shows the same group that is, Alexander Gardner actually published a catalog of available photographs for sale, more than 400. By September 1863, the catalogs at the Library of Congress. And there is the companion view where the officers are not drinking was advertised for sale in the catalog. But this photograph shows the same group, and everybody's broken out the bottles. it was not offered for sale in the catalog. It was obviously a private photograph. Gardner was friends with these guys. And so the photograph of McClellan's staff having a cocktail party on the Antietam battlefield on the day Lincoln visited is also right up there because I actually discovered it.
Wow, that is interesting. In recent years, it was determined that at least a couple of the photographs of the Civil War in Gettysburg particularly may have been manipulated, with the photographers arriving after the battle and perhaps taking newly deceased soldiers and driving them to different locations and posing them with different uniforms. Can you explain why that might have happened?
Well, it's a frequent question, and I can say that there's only one known instance of it happening, and it's the photograph of the sharpshooter in the sharpshooter's nest of the Convergent Rocks in Devil's Den at Gettysburg. And Bill Frassinito, the dean of our field, in his groundbreaking studies basically determined that the same body is visible in it's two or three photographs from Gettysburg, lying in a different location. So they dragged it over to this more or less perfect photo location. The Convergent Rocks there looks like a sharpshooter's nest, and obviously was used for cover. So they took the body over there, and they took both the large plate and stereoscopic glass plate negatives of the body laying there. That's the only time it ever happened.
Okay.
Now, there are some photographs around wartime showing people posing as bodies in Devil's Den by a different photographer. And there are photographs where stuff has been added to the photo. The gruesome photograph of the eviscerated soldier at Gettysburg, where you can see his rib cage. They put a rifle, a musket down next to him, and there's a shell in the photograph. And that was done on a number of occasions. But actually moving a body, none of the Antietam photographs of the dead, Some of them are in the, laying on the battlefield as they fell, and others they've dragged together for burial. But there was no moving of bodies by the photographers at Antietam. There's seven different instances in the war where photographs of the dead were taken out in the field, either where they fell or, you know, being buried. And really, there's about 100 different photos in Antietam, Gettysburg, Petersburg, Fredericksburg, Corinth, Mississippi, so a couple of other locations. About a total of 100 photos of the dead, and the only one that where they moved the body was that one.
That clarifies
that. And it
was
done to, enhance, you know, get a good, the photo of the so-called dead sharpshooter in the sharpshooter's nest at Gettysburg is one of the most evocative photographs of
right.
the Civil War. So. Now, there's a couple, you know, there's some myths about Civil War photography I should mention. One of the myths is that photographs, by the end of the war, people were tired of the war. And so Alexander Gardner produced this book called The Sketchbook of the Civil War. And it's one of the rarest books in existence because nobody bought it because everybody was tired of the war. It's utter hogwash. The Alexander Gardner Sketchbook of the War was 100 albumen prints hand-pasted onto pages. It was a book that was produced by subscription only. They made 200 copies. It cost $150 per volume, or, you know, per book. It was two volumes, but the book cost $150, which is, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 today. And it nearly sold out. So that in itself was incorrect. At the time I began studying Civil War photography, it was thought that maybe 3 or 4 copies existed. One of our members polled all the institutions and libraries in the country and has found more than 80 full intact copies of the book still exist out of 200. So, you know, it's just not true that the other aspect of it, that the other myth was, or another myth that supported that, or that basically blows that myth out of the water, is the fact that the most extensive stereoscopic series, stereo view series, not only of the Civil War, but I think of the entire stereo era, which lasted well into the 20th century, was the E&HT Anthony War for the Union series. They produced more than 1,100 separate stereo views published on cards. On yellow-colored cards, and also you found them on orange-colored cards. And it was immensely, it was a bestseller. I mean, in terms of stereoscopic photographs, the War for the Union series was a bestseller because they're very commonly found on today's antique photographic market. You can tell which are the most popular photographs of the war because you find them more frequently on the antique photo market. An Antietam view of the Dunker Church with the dead in the foreground is one of the most commonly found cards.
Right, right.
I mean, you don't find them all the time. You don't see them at every show, but having collected over 40 years, I can tell you I've seen it numerous times.
Right.
And so I know that it was one of the most popular views back then.
About, I guess it was maybe 2007 or 2008, I attended the Lincoln Forum in Gettysburg, and there was a photograph that had been enlarged at Gettysburg and was said to be a photograph of Abraham Lincoln on his horse. I believe you were involved in that particular photograph. Can you tell us about that?
Well, this was a result of the scanning project at the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress ended up with most of the original documentary negatives, most specifically the collection of negatives of Alexander Gardner, and also the collection I was just telling you about, the E&HT Anthony War for the Union series. Nearly all of those negatives still exist. So they're talking about 2,000 or more documentary photographs. And one of the stereo documentary negatives in the Gardner collection, actually three of them, are entitled "Crowd at the Dedication of the National Cemetery in Gettysburg," basically the Gettysburg Address ceremony. And they're just shots of the crowd, and you can really you can't make out much, just looking at a say a print or the negative itself or the positive from the negative. But the negative is 4 by 10 inches. It's stereoscopic negative. All three of them stereo, and they're all 4 by 10 inches. And so there's a lot of detail within. So after the scanning project, the Library of Congress, our imaging director, John Richter, was studying, not only studying the depths of the photograph, but studying it in 3D. And I went to his house, and he didn't tell me about it. He said, "Hey, I want you to look at this photograph." And so he zoomed in on this crowd, this boring crowd scene, and starts scanning across it, and it's in 3D, and all of a sudden it's a different photo, because all this 3D starts, when you zoom in on these 3D photographs, you find more 3D. And so this scene was just an electrifying panorama suddenly, and as he's scanning across, there's this one person, everybody else, all the union officers, their blue uniforms come off as almost black, but not black. Well, this guy's sitting on horseback with a beard and a top hat, and he's wearing a black outfit. And he's in profile, and I said, "My God, that's Lincoln." And there's two images of him taken within 60 seconds of each other. I mean, Gardner is working fast. And one of them shows him raising his left arm is raised, and it's all white. And it's well documented that he was wearing white riding gloves as he came into that ceremony. And basically, bottom line for me is Gardner took two photographs. He didn't go to Gettysburg not to get a picture of Lincoln. He went to Gettysburg to get a picture of Lincoln like he did in Antietam. But he got stuck on this photograph stand that's a long distance from the speaker stand. And he had to be disappointed. I've never seen the photograph in a stereo card format. He must have been disappointed and didn't market it. But the negatives survived, and they're in his collection. And basically, he shot two photos as fast as he could to capture Lincoln when, as it's documented, he on horseback turned to acknowledge the troops who had created a corridor for him to ride on his horse to the speaker stand. And on his way to the speaker stand, he stopped and he turned back and he faced the troops, and Gardner took two photographs, and he's sitting on top of the horse in the same exact position in each image. However, about 3 or 4 years ago, a UNC professor who's been studying Lincoln, Christopher Oakley, found Lincoln elsewhere in the picture. Oakley's Lincoln only shows up in one of the two negatives. And there's no possible way that Gardner was shooting this photograph trying to capture this guy, because he's really obscure. But, you look at it, and he's a guy with a beard and a top hat. So that's all I think he is. But Christopher Oakley has his theories, and when he came to me with the, with his study, I don't think that's Lincoln. I think our guy is Lincoln, but of course I'm biased. So I submitted it to Bill Frassinito. I said, "Go visit Bill Frassinito and show him the picture, and go visit Harold Holzer." And both of them like Oakley's Lincoln better. So what can you say? I mean, the way I deal with it, the way I dealt with it in Battlefield Photographer, when the controversy came up, was to let both write stories of equal length, which I ran side by side in the publication. It was like, shoot it out. You're going to have to make, and that's how I do in slideshows today. I will show our Lincoln, and then I show Christopher Oakley's Lincoln, and I said, "You're going to have to decide for yourself," but because sometimes in Civil War photography, you come up with these these questions, and you really can't solidly answer them. You can't be sure. There's a photograph at Gettysburg, one of the most famous photographs. It's called Harvest of Death, and it shows a group of dead soldiers lying on the battlefield as they fell. They have not been moved at all, so you could see, you know, how they fell as they went across the battlefield. The location for that photograph has never been positively discovered, and yet there are at least 30 different locations. I mean, people, obsessed people, spend hours trying to find this location and or convince Bill Frasenito or Gary Edelman that this is the actual location. And not a single location has been found that basically qualifies by their very strict and rigid standards about location. There's just no rock in the scene that you can line it up with today. And it's, you know, just this ongoing great mystery, you know. I mean, so we found two Lincolns, and there's a third Lincoln that's been posited, in these photographs from Gettysburg. But hey, you've already got Harvest of Death in 30 different locations, and they haven't, and it hasn't been definitively determined exactly where this photograph was taken.
But the Center for Civil War Photography did determine that a photograph taken in Frederick, Maryland, that supposedly was of Lee's army in 1862, you determined that that was taken later. How did that work out?
Well, I think that the weight of evidence, there were two times the Confederate Army was in Frederick, Maryland, when they came through on the way to Antietam, and then in July 1864, when Early's troops came through before the battle outside Washington at Fort Stevens. And actually, basically, the location of the image was somewhat in question. There's a historical marker on the street in Frederick that identifies the location where the image was taken, and it's wrong. And our researchers, there's three bylines on the article, but anyway, our researchers discovered, these guys were actually researching it themselves, and they came to me, and I said, yes, we can make this into an article. The photograph was actually taken around the corner on North Market Street, and they determined the exact spot where it was taken and recreated it using this, you know, three-story pole that they had the camera up on the third floor. They determined that it was taken. It's been credited over the years as being taken by a Frederick businessman named Rosenstock, because you can see the Rosenstock sign down in the photograph. And they showed through their research that Rosenstock never took any photographs, and then in fact it was taken by a well-known Frederick photographer, Jacob Byerly, or taken from the Byerly Gallery by either Byerly or his son or an assistant. And that was somewhat known, but they also studied the movements of the Confederate Army, and basically that when the Confederate Army came into Frederick and went out of Frederick in September 1862, they didn't pass Byerly's gallery. But when they came through in 1864, they did. And there's several other pieces of information, details in the photograph that point towards the 1864 date. There were a lot of people on the street, according to the newspaper accounts, in September 1862. You know, the army had been under orders to not mess with anybody. They were trying to be as well behaved as they could in September 1862 for invading the border state of Maryland. 1864, the story was different. You know, they demanded and received a $300,000 ransom, a huge, you know, six-figure ransom from Frederick. in order not to burn the city like they did in Chambersburg. And there's nobody really on the street other than soldiers in the photograph of Frederick. And that sort of points towards it being more likely 1864. They did not determine definitively that it was 1864. It's the weight of evidence that basically points towards the later date.
So as we're
let me just mention one. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. We're fine.
Well,
go ahead.
One of the questions that you included that I've always been tickled by that I wanted to touch on is the story of Matthew Brady, because Brady is simultaneously in some places credited for taking every single Civil War photograph that was
right.
ever taken.
Right.
If you look at Roy Meredith's best-selling 1952 book, Mr. Lincoln's Cameraman, which is just crammed with falsehoods and problems and bad stuff, and yet was a bestseller back then because it was almost like a revelation or something. Anyway, every photograph, and all of Gardner's and other photographers, it's like every photograph is credited to Brady. So that's the worst example to that in that direction, because there's lots and lots of photos in that book that he wasn't involved in. The other side of the coin is that Matthew Brady took no photographs at all during the Civil War because his eyesight was so bad. Well, sit down and think about it for a minute. What do you do when your eyesight's bad? You wear glasses. All right, so Matthew Brady wore glasses. That didn't stop him from being able to operate a camera. If not operate the camera himself, it was more because it was kind of somebody else's job. I mean, you look at a Steven Spielberg movie, and Steven Spielberg did not operate the camera, but he did everything else, and so it's a Spielberg movie. I think of Brady photographs in the same way. There's no question that Matthew Brady was intimately involved in the production of a lot of his Civil War photographs. He was in the field every single year of the war. In 1861, he went to Bull Run. In 1862, he was in Maryland. In 1863, he went to Gettysburg personally. In 1864, he was at Cold Harbor, personally directing all the photographs of Grant. And so, in 1865, he arrived at Robert E. Lee's door days after Lee had come back from Appomattox in defeat and convinced Robert E. Lee to pose at his back door in uniform, thereby capturing the most famous photographs of Robert E. Lee. That was Matthew Brady's work. You can see Matthew Brady photographs have a different style than some of the other photographs. You can see him in the Gettysburg photographs. He invites viewers to paint their own picture of what the battle must have been like with his panoramas from Gettysburg. He put himself in more than 30 photographs in the field. That in itself shows that he helped compose photographs. So basically, if you go to the index of my history of Civil War photography, Matthew Brady has more mentions than any other photographer. And I think he's right there at the top of the list, because he did unquestionably, his firm produced, hundreds and hundreds of Civil War photographs. I think he was personally involved in the composition of many images, even if he didn't actually go through the process of, sensitizing the plates and operating the camera. There's one photograph where you can see him just to the left of the camera, right on the edge of the photograph, and it, as if he's there, like, okay, pose this way, look that way, And
right.
So I always like to clarify Matthew Brady's role. It falls somewhere in between the not taking a single one and taking every single photograph.
Right.
Neither of those are true.
Thanks for clarifying that.
So, I mean, I have a question that I think will be more philosophical than anything. But, when we look at the history of the Civil War, really most history, probably, we're looking at a lot of text. Text is where we get most of our information from, letters, official documents, all that sort of thing. But obviously, we can pull a certain amount of data from pictures, right? In the case of the Civil War, you know, maybe video and stuff as we go on. What portion of our knowledge of the Civil War do you think comes from photographic evidence as opposed from text? Or if that's a hard question to answer, what do pictures tell us that text really can't?
I'd say a significant portion comes from photographs, and more so, more information than ever before in the last, say, 40 or 50 years. For the first 100 years, Civil War photos were used, if not in Miller's photographic history, where there's a compilation. They're either a compilation of photographs, or they were used basically to illustrate books. And nobody really spent any time, you know, trying to figure out exactly what they showed. So the dean of our field is William Frassinito, and his first book, Gettysburg, A Journey in Time, was a huge bestseller. It sold more than 100,000 copies, and it was a revelation because Bill was the first guy to start to study the photographs of the Civil War intensely for the historical information that they contained. And he, one photograph of the dead at Gettysburg, he had found in his books identified in six separate different locations. It was sort of like the harvest of death that I was talking about, except that in this one, there was a rock in the background, the split rock, a big boulder that had a crack in it. He spent countless hours trying to find this rock and finally did discover it. And it opened, it showed that a series of the dead of Gettysburg were taken at this rather obscure location called the Rose Farm. And his study of the dead, of the photographs, eventually opened up knowledge through, you know, written records.
Will you please give my listeners information on your books and how they might purchase them?
Well, the books I've done on Civil War photography, four books, are no longer in print. That's the Civil War in Depth, the Civil War in Depth Volume 2, Lincoln in 3D. All three of those are 3D books published by Chronicle Books, but they're not in print. But all three of them are available at reasonable prices on Amazon.
Can you tell us when your next Civil War photography seminar is?
The last weekend in September in Richmond, Virginia. You'll be able to find out more and sign up for it on our website, www.civilwarphotography.org.
Thank you, sir, for being on our program the last 2 weeks. I've certainly learned a lot. We really appreciate it. You're listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is your host, Bob O'Connor. We'll be right back. This weekend's events include living history programs both days at Pickett's Mill Battlefield Historic Site near Dallas, Georgia, a lecture Saturday at 2 entitled War on the Border, 1854-1865, Kansas and Missouri, at Constitution Hall in Lee Compton, Kansas, and a free lecture on Saturday at 1:30 at the Visitor Center at Gettysburg National Military Park on the topic of the 1938 reunion of the Blue and the Gray. Today's little-known American Civil War fact is this. The Confederate Army marched into Gettysburg mostly from the north. The Union Army marched into Gettysburg from the south. Did they do that to confuse us? Probably not. The Confederate Army was in the vicinity of Carlisle and Harrisburg. The Union Army was in the vicinity of Northern Maryland. Today in American Civil War history, February 7, 1861, the second day of meetings were held for the Provisional Congress of the Confederate States of America at Montgomery, Alabama. The seven members present were Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Texas. On our next week's program, we'll feature Mantha Young, who will be speaking about the Alusti Battle reenactment coming up in Florida in February. To contact us, please send an email to chronicles@BobO'ConnorBooks.com. Beatrice Bowling of Harpers Ferry, Iowa writes, "Whenever you mention Harpers Ferry, I think Iowa, but I think you are talking mostly about Virginia during the war and now West Virginia. It makes me smile. Yes, ma'am, I've actually been to Harpers Ferry, Iowa, as my sister lives across the river in Wisconsin. Your comments made me smile." Tommy Henderson of Salt Lake City, Utah writes in an email, "Love your pod. Am surprised by all that I've learned. Thought I knew a lot, but I'm finding out that I learn from almost every program. Great job. Especially like Mark's intelligent questions."
Oh, that's nice of him.
I do, too. You're pretty good. Pretty soon you'll be asking all the questions, and then you'll let me ask one at the end.
All right. That's what I'm working on. We're getting there.
Joanne White of Fairville, Wisconsin, a regular listener, writes, "Listen to both pods by Dr. Tom Clements talking about Ezra Carman. Wow, amazing story. And his journey to footnote the 1,800 handwritten pages was also amazing. I love hearing the story of how Ezra Carman helped with Antietam and all the signage. Great pods." A final message of the day comes from Major and Marilyn Brownstone of St. Anne, Illinois. Didn't even know there was a St. Anne, Illinois, and I grew up in Illinois. "Bravo, good stuff. We are new to your programs and are racing to catch up. We especially like the programs by Dr. Clemens a few weeks ago. Thanks to my ace producer, Mark Guiney, and today's guest, Bob Zeller. Thanks to you for listening. Please join us next week, same time, same podcast location, for the Chronicles of the American Civil War."
The years creep slowly by, Lorena. The snow is on the grass again. The sun's low down the sky, Lorena. The frost gleams where the flowers have been.